From the newsroom of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Parent. This week's bombing that took place in the Thai capital, Bangkok, was not only shocking and bloody, it also breached a seemingly convention of not deliberately targeting foreigners, a convention that's held through most of the country's long history of coups and crises. The fact that the atrocity happened at a Hindu-inspired religious shrine outside a five-star hotel in Bangkok's wealthiest shopping district marks a serious shift. So far, at least more than 10 foreigners are believed to be among the dead. It's a big test for the military-run government, which is painting itself as an attempt to undermine the tourism-dependent economy. It says it's already identified a possible suspect from CCTV footage. Peter Lloyd reports.
There was an eerie quiet at the normally bustling Ratchaprasong intersection in central Bangkok today as forensics experts picked through the shattered remains of the famed Erawan Shrine for clues to the bombing. The CCTV footage that shows the horror of the explosion has already given up a possible lead. But right now, there is more fear than certainty. There's a sense of outrage at the carnage. Somyat Pumpumlang is Thailand's national police chief.
The perpetrators are cruel and heartless because they intend to take lives. Everyone knows that at 7 p.m. at the shrine, there are a lot of people gathered around there, both Thais and foreign tourists. So if they plant a bomb there, they know or can assume they will cause casualties.
The Erawan Shrine is an accidental attraction. In the 1950s, when a hotel was under construction nearby, a series of accidents and deaths spooked superstitious locals. They built a miniature wooden house to appease the spirits. In later years, a more permanent Hindu-inspired construction took its place. For years, locals have crowded the shrine at all hours, praying, making offerings of sweets and burning incense. The shrine captured the attention of visitors too. It was part faith, part prop for a photo opportunity, until the staggering violence of last night. Locals now worry what the attack will mean. I think this will affect our economy badly, said one passerby, adding, it also affects badly people's minds, both locals and tourists. The dead include Chinese holidaymakers, now the bedrock of Thailand's tourism sector. Some came from Malaysia and Singapore too. One sign that the military government is scrambling to reassure the world, as well as the Thai people, came when the deputy government spokesman, Major General Werachon Sekun Hapatipak, went on national television and spoke in English.
The public are advised to remain calm and monitor the situation regularly as security agencies conduct their operations. As for possible motivation to those who may have caused this incident, it is too early to speculate which group may have been responsible for this crime, but authorities are following possible leads.
A military government seized power last year in a coup with palace backing, but the military is not united. Thaksin Shinawatra lives in exile, but still has ambitions to return home and reclaim his fortune and political power. Thais who support Thaksin and oppose the old order military and Bangkok elite have fast become suspects. Nicholas Farrelly from the ANU studies the Thai political scene and runs the university's Asia-watching online magazine, New Mandala.
It comes at an inelegant moment for Thailand's military regime. They've been hoping to get a number of other sensitive issues fully under control, and now they're having to deal with this huge attention that has followed the blast. The very large numbers of people who've been killed and injured suggest that this is an attack orchestrated by a purposeful and professional outfit. Everybody's so familiar with that neighbourhood, it really strikes at the heart of so much of the success that Thailand's been able to garner for itself as it's built up its tourist economy.
Is it, in fact, targeting the one part of the economy that's tracking quite well, tourism, especially the East Asian tourism market for the Thais?
The economy, as you'd expect, hasn't been going all that well, and yet tourists, of course, force have continued to flock to the kingdom. It was anticipated before this attack that in October of this year, in the 1 month alone, Thailand would receive 1 million Chinese visitors.
It's impossible to look at this without looking at it through the prism of the political settlement in Thailand and how it's unresolved.
That's right. We still don't have answers to the big questions about how Thailand will manage its internal affairs long term. There's no consensus about what kind of democratic system should be implemented, nor is there, at least among many important players, some level of agreement about what will happen around the palace when the current king is no longer on the throne, and the military regime are doing whatever they possibly can to keep their hands on the levers of power as they seek to manage that transition for their own purposes.
At the shrine in Bangkok, where the blast took place this week, the police still have the area cordoned off, and they're still looking for clues about who can find it. As we mentioned a moment ago, there is a suspect that was caught on a CCTV camera. Next, Rachel Brown talks to some of the witnesses about what they saw.
The streets around the bomb site in Bangkok's commercial district are still closed as police and soldiers inspect the debris-strewn scene. Oi. Thai police have confirmed the blast near the popular religious shrine was caused by an improvised explosive device loaded with TNT. The National Police Chief Somyot Phumphumwang says whoever orchestrated the bombing at the crowded tourist attraction intended to take lives.
The blast radius of the bomb is about 100 metres. The bomb experts say that the device weighed about 3 kilograms.
I saw fire, I saw people bleeding on the street and screaming.
Office worker Mark Padavia was walking by the shrine when the shockwave bowled him over.
Everybody started running in different directions. It was pure mayhem.
The BBC's Jonathan Head was one of the first on the scene.
The injuries to people were just of the most horrific kind. A lot of people gather around this shrine. It's particularly popular with Chinese tourists who come in very large numbers to Thailand. And at that time of day, there would have been many dozens packed around the central statue, on their knees with joss sticks. I saw children as well. I saw one woman picking up a dead child. Just dreadful, dreadful scenes.
New Zealand expat paramedic Marco Cunningham says he's never seen injuries like this before.
Legs ripped off or half ripped off, bones shredded from a blast. You know, it was incredibly powerful.
Sanjeev Viet was on the skywalk.
It was like this huge gust of wind and debris just flying through you, and I actually fell it up on the skywalk. And then I see like bodies everywhere, and their cars on fire, their bikes everywhere, and then people are screaming and shouting, and their traffic is, everybody's honking, it's utter chaos and mayhem.
The Deputy Thai Premier has called an emergency meeting with government officials and military officers in charge of national security. He says the incident might scare foreign tourists from Bangkok and cripple Thailand's tourist industry and economy as a whole. Since the blast, the Thai baht has dropped to its weakest level since April 2009. No group has claimed responsibility, but the Royal Thai Army Chief and Deputy Defence Minister says neither the attack nor the type of bomb matches those used by separatist rebels in Thailand's south.
That was Rachel Brown reporting. As the story develops, we will bring you more on it. Well, first China devalued the yuan, and then they devalued it again. Another crash on China's volatile share market is fueling concerns about the accelerating slowdown in the world's second biggest economy. Stocks plunged more than 6% this week as investors reacted to the news that Chinese regulators will allow market forces to play a bigger role in determining the stock prices. Here's our business editor, Peter Ryan.
China is learning the hard way that its approach to a command economy doesn't translate into the share market that's meant to be free and open and away from government intervention. But in June and July, as the main markets in Shanghai and Shenzhen crashed by a third, Chinese authorities came to the rescue to prop up the market with cash and allowed big stocks to suspend themselves from trade. Now China's securities regulator says the government will allow market forces to play a bigger role in setting stock prices. But that's unsettled local investors who still believe the big hand of China's government is a safety net. According to Jonathan Schiesel, head of global equities at Ashburton Investments in London.
The government has been somewhat panicked. There was certainly a commitment from the regulators and the government in China to start opening these markets up, to start having more transparent rules and regulations. What we've seen in reaction to the big falls in the stock market is a rollback of some of that commitment to reform.
And that's blurred the image that China wants to portray to the West, that it's moving to compete on global markets without the perception that Chinese authorities are pulling the levers. But Jonathan Schiesel says not everyone is convinced just yet.
Really, from an external investor's point of view, that makes this market somewhat unattractive in the short term. What investors like to see is steady regulation and not suddenly whipsawing around the place, rules and regulations changing. So in the short term, it's put a bit of a cloud over the market because we just really don't know what's going to happen tomorrow.
The latest share crash comes as China is moving to list government utilities and pension funds on its market, which could raise hundreds of billions, maybe trillions of dollars. But analyst Mike Sorrentino says while Chinese authorities appear to be easing up on the intervention, it won't happen right away.
In the long run, everybody benefits if the market is taking over control of pricing China and their economy. So any kind of short-term issues with them, I mean, they can't really flip the light switch, right? It's going to take them some time to really get from point A to point B. So we could see some more volatility for sure, but I'm not necessarily concerned at all.
Yesterday's 6% plunge in China comes after last week's surprise devaluation of China's currency over consecutive days, a move that rocked financial markets around the world.
10 years ago this week, the Indonesian government and rebels from the country's Aceh province signed a historic peace deal. It put 29 years of conflict in the region at an end. It was participated in the devastating 2004 Boxing Day tsunami. Our Indonesia correspondent, George Roberts, traveled to Aceh and filed this report.
Indonesian tanks versus heavily armed Free Aceh Movement, or GAM, rebels. Riel Marizal was among those fighting Indonesian troops.
I joined GAM when I was 20. Daily activities for me was farming, going on patrols. We had commanders, and our commanders would give orders. So when they said, today you are going to war, then we would go to war.
The conflict in Aceh lasted 29 years and then stopped after the devastating Boxing Day tsunami, which claimed more than 230,000 lives in more than a dozen countries, most of them in Aceh.
The good thing that came from it was peace. Without the tsunami, we might not have peace now. Because there were a lot of foreigners who came to Aceh for humanitarian reasons, Aceh had peace. Life is better now.
Riel Marizal and his fellow former rebel Don Zulkiram have traded their battle fatigues for hiking boots.
After the peace deal, we live in safety. When I want to go out at night, it is safe. Before the peace deal, I would be at home by 7 p.m. because I couldn't go anywhere.
They now take tourists on treks to their former jungle hideout.
We were unemployed, so we became farmers and worked as guides. We take tourists to the mountains for the tourism and for the scenery.
In the capital, Banda Aceh, Salmi is a tour guide at a monument, a reminder of the power of the tsunami. A boat still sits where the waves dumped it.
Unfortunately, I couldn't find my family yet. My lovely mother, grandfather, grandmother, younger sister, two of them, couldn't find until now.
But she says some aspects of life in Aceh have improved, such as work rights for women and job prospects.
Because of tsunami, they have to do something to survive, to earn the money. So it makes us, not, as I told you, not sad every day. It's not good. So we can think about the future. What should we do if the disaster come again? Yeah, so Many people think about that. I think there's a good thing behind all this disaster.
A local Archanese businesswoman, Poppy Ferdianti, worked for World Vision in the wake of the tsunami.
Other changes that I've seen. After the tsunami, Aceh became more open. We no longer have conflicts here. And Aceh has been more open to diversity.
A disaster with a silver lining.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. A predominant publisher in Tonga says Pacific governments find it difficult to implement reforms because of bureaucracy within the civil service. Kalafi Mohola has served as an advisor to the current government and says institutionalized bureaucracy and cultural traditions often mean change is not as fast as it should be and as fast as the government wants. He spoke to Koro Valoka.
I believe that the existence of any bureaucracies really serve the vision for any organization, the vision for a country, for government. And that vision is actually provided by the leadership. The leadership knows how to implement or to bring about that vision, the right things to do, the kind of things that needs to be done in order to bring about that vision or make the vision a reality. Whereby in a bureaucracy, what they're most concerned about is basically to keep the status quo, to keep doing things the right way. They care much less about doing the right things as much as they care whatever they're doing, that it's done the right way. There's nothing wrong with it. It's done legally, that there are legislations, that there are policies that they follow. The only problem with that is that a lot of the policies that they follow are established by previous governments, and those previous governments may not be favorable to reform.
This is such a problem in the Pacific because there's a kind of institutional bureaucracy because of the cultural elements. Can you describe that, touch on that?
You take in the case of Tonga, for example, we do have a government in place that have only been in government for 7 months. Part of the difficulty from the prime minister and some of the people that he's brought into leadership with this government is that they were in opposition for 25 or more years. So the only thing they've known is being in opposition. So they've come in to run a government without much experience at all. And of course, you have a bureaucracy that sits there with all the years of experience and tradition, the way things are being run, and immediately there's a bit of discomfort. The other thing, too, is that like every bureaucracy, I think, in every nation, it's very much embedded in the culture of that particular place. In the Pacific, we're very much steeped in culture. We respect our culture. We live our culture out on a daily basis. And part of the problem with this culture is that you've got a whole leadership structure and that's based on entitlements. Like in the situation in Tonga, we've got royal family, we've got nobility and the aristocracy. And we're very much a stratified society. And you carry on those kind of elements in the culture into a bureaucracy or into a government, and often you find some very difficult situations.
Wholesale changes in the bureaucracy at the same time as the government, sweeping changes in the civil service. Is that something that maybe could happen in the Pacific, or that's not the answer?
If you talk to bureaucrats in the Pacific, they tell you, people that work in government, that they are apolitical. Their commitment and their task is to serve whoever and whatever it is that is in government. I think it would be a difficult thing. Definitely there are some changes in personnel that you've got to bring about, particularly at the CEO level or the director level. But what is needed is wholesale training that needs to have that bureaucracy or the civil service be retrained to be able to carry out the kind of task that will help fulfill the vision. Because often in the Pacific, you have leaders that come in with all kinds of excitement and vision to reform, and then they end up, they themselves are being changed by the bureaucracy. The bureaucracy becomes the one that is in control, and that's why so often in many island nations, you have politicians that are coming into power, and they preach and they herald particular vision, and after 4 years or 5 years of being in power, they end up doing the exact same things that previous governments have done.
Is there hope in Tonga's case? Is there an alignment happening?
There is an alignment happening. It's pretty slow, of course, but I think we've identified the main stumbling blocks to reform. And the stumbling blocks is not outside. It's actually within the spheres of power. But there is hope here, yes. I think there is a slow movement. What I'm afraid of is that by the time the term of this government finishes, they are basically just learning how to drive the vehicle, how to drive the ship. This is the advantage that you see, like a government that's been in Samoa, whereby the leader or the party, they've been in government now for some time. And in many ways, the longevity of the time they've been in government allows them to bring about the changes.
Three more people have appeared in court in Fiji charged with sedition. They are among dozens who have been rounded up over the last 6 weeks on sedition charges. The story so far has proved thick on intrigue, but thin on evidence, and has left many in Fiji baffled. Sally Round spoke to correspondent Mary Wilson.
Well, it's been hard to keep count as everyday groups are appearing in courts in the north and west of the main island of Viti Levu. But I've done a count up, and so far 65 people, nearly all of them men, have appeared in court. Some of them hold chiefly titles, and they come from rural areas, from Thuvu in the west up to Rakiraki in the north. And some are appearing in pairs, others in groups of 16 or so. Now, they've all been charged with sedition and either urging political violence or inciting communal antagonism, which are all offences under Fiji's crimes decree. All of them have been remanded in custody after the state prosecutors stressed the seriousness of the charges and ongoing police investigations.
So what's the evidence against them?
Well, very few, if any, facts have come out in court so far, and the lawyer representing many of these people has told me the whole thing is farcical. He says many of these people don't know what they've been charged with, and some have been kept in custody beyond the time legally allowed before a court appearance. He's very upset at the lack of due process for some of these people. One group from Ra province has been in court in relation to reports of attempts to form a breakaway Christian state and paramilitary training with an ex-British Army officer in the hill country there. And yesterday in court, prosecutors said one group of 16 accused from the Nandronga area in the west had gone so far as to draw up documents establishing a breakaway state in November last year.
And what are the police saying then?
We spoke to Fiji's police commissioner Ben Groenewald, and he has confirmed to us a group of men has been conducting military-style training in the hills of Ra province, and he described them as members of a rural cult. He told us there are kingpins and they had already been arrested. There have been unconfirmed reports of weapons being used in the training and being imported into Fiji, but the police chief told us the training involved wooden replicas rather than the real thing. And the authorities say there's no evidence to suggest the people up in court recently have anything to do with the alleged paramilitary training in Ra.
And the public's view on this? Is it possible to say what ordinary people in Fiji think is going on?
Yes, well, I had a talk to our correspondent there in Suva, and he says people are just watching and waiting with interest to see how the whole thing unfolds. But there's a lot of confusion and concern at mixed messages from the authorities. Now, the political parties appear to be distancing themselves from the arrests, although sources I've spoken to within the indigenous-backed Sedelpa party say the actions of these alleged breakaway groups show how many indigenous Fijians fear their land rights and their culture, their Christian faith, are under threat by the Bainimarama government. Now, interestingly, there has been a change in military command at the same time as all this has been going on, with the Brigadier General Musesi Tikui Tonga stepping down. But our contacts in Fiji don't believe there's any connection to the sedition accusations. The Prime Minister, Frank Bainimarama, last week weighed into the whole affair with a strong speech, saying anyone challenging the state's authority will face the full force of the law, and any insurrection, as he put it, will be crushed.
And finally on the program, a child protection crisis is unfolding in Tasmania, Australia. Staff have failed to follow up 151 cases on the state's northwest coast in this past year, and it's still unclear why. Some of the children waited almost a year before child protection investigated. Now a woman who had concerns about health of a baby has come forward, saying she believes she is one of the people who made the notification to child protection that wasn't followed up. Felicity Ogilvy reports from Hobart.
In the past year, child protection workers on Tasmania's northwest coast have failed to follow up 151 notifications. The failure was only recently discovered by the department. The unions and the minister's office were told about the child protection failure last week. But the minister responsible, Jackie Petrusma, was kept in the dark until Monday.
Many things in the department, what they see as an operational matter. Unfortunately, what has happened has happened. This is now about moving on from here. A report is being done into what has happened so that we can actually make sure that in the future that Tasmania has the best child protection system that it can.
The minister is under pressure to explain just how 151 notifications went unchecked for so long. But she can't give an answer because she's waiting for the department that kept her in the dark about its failure to prepare a report. It's not clear how much of that report will be made public.
Well, we have to remember that we're talking about children here, 151 cases, so that we have to be careful about what is publicly released.
While the government may never publicly release the details of the children affected by the department's mistake, one member of the public has spoken out. A woman who doesn't want to be identified believes she is one of the people who made a notification that wasn't followed up. She says that she called Child Protection Services on the northwest coast in June to make a notification about a baby's medical needs.
It was answered by a receptionist who told me the workers were too busy to take my call and that I'd have to put in a notification via their online service, which you go to on the website and type in all the details and send it off. So I did that.
The woman says she only got a call back from Child Protection last week asking if they needed to do a home visit.
The child had been seen by medical professionals, but that was facilitated through contacts with the family community services, not through the help of Child Protection, and the family is yet to be visited by Child Protection.
I'm not aware of that case. I'd have to look into the situation in that case. But as I said before, there's extra Child Protection workers up there now going through all these cases to make sure that these children are looked at and looked at correctly according to our statutory responsibilities.
Opposition MP Rebecca White used question time to grill the minister about the safety of all the children affected by the failure in child protection.
Minister, yesterday you failed to guarantee whether any of the 56 children who have now progressed through assessment to investigation were harmed due to the severe failure of process in the northwest. Minister, you've had an additional 24 hours to receive updates about this very serious issue. Can you now answer the question?
The Minister for Human Services, Jackie Petrusma, says all of the 151 cases have now been assessed and 95 have been closed.
Advice received directly from the field is that there are no priority ones, Madam Speaker.
That does not mean that.
It would also appear that many others will be either closed or referred to either Gateway or Family Support Services, Madam Speaker.
Order.
Madam Speaker, from that, a small number of these cases will then be progressed through for detailed case management.
The minister is taking responsibility for the failure in Child Protection Services, but she doesn't plan to resign.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you want to contact us, our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. You can listen to this program again, as well as past editions and some of our special documentaries, by visiting our website at any time, www.pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying so long, take care. And those listening in Papua New Guinea, Fiji, and other regions in Micronesia and the Pacific, stay tuned because you can catch a daily version of the show as well. Until next time, friends, so long and take care.